Today is Wednesday, January 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the White House continues to praise anti-government protesters in Iran.
We are expressing our support, as we have many occasions before, for the Iranian people, understanding that it is brave, that they are courageous in speaking out publicly and forcefully.
President Trump ramps up his Twitter attacks against North Korea's leader. Airline safety hits a major milestone in 2017. And also ahead, the pinball game is seeing a big resurgence. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, in a New Year's Day tweet, President Trump said the United States had received nothing but lies and deceit in return for, quote, foolishly giving Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid in the last 15 years to fight terrorism. His criticism instantly provoked strong reaction from Pakistani politicians and commentators. The foreign ministry Monday night summoned the U.S. ambassador to protest and seek an explanation. At Tuesday's White House briefing, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about the president's tweets.
Our goal is that we know that they can do more to stop terrorism, and we want them to do that. That seems pretty simple. In terms of specific actions, I think you'll see some more details come out on that in the next 24 to 48 hours.
The Pakistani government did issue a formal response Tuesday to what it described as the completely incomprehensible tweet after an emergency meeting with the National Security Committee. Joining us now is Christine Fair, Distinguished Associate Professor at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. Thank you for being with us. So what exactly is your response to the president's tweets on Pakistan?
So this is really a genuinely fake story. So what are the actual facts? There was this guy named Barack Hussein Obama. And in August 2007, when he wanted to be the president, he campaigned on, and I kid you not, unilateral military strikes against Pakistan because he had identified Pakistan as a harbor of terrorist organizations. And once Barack Hussein Obama became the president, he actually followed through on those campaign promises. He escalated drone strikes. In the first 2 years of his presidency, he essentially decimated the presence of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, whereas the entire 8 years of the Bush administration did very little to do so.
Then what is the point of the tweets all of a sudden out of nowhere aimed at Pakistan when we're already sort of having very tense relations with, Iran, North Korea?
To unpack that, you kind of have to understand actually what the Trump administration has done. It's made it more easy to give more important money to Pakistan. How does this work? So as I said, FMF, Foreign Military Financing, only allows Pakistan to use our money to buy our goods and services, right? So this is a program that aids us. So President Trump says, no FMF for you, which really penalizes us more than the Pakistanis because it means that some country can't find a way of laundering $255 million back into our defense industry. The most important program that Pakistan has benefited from and the Trump administration has done nothing about and has said nothing about is what's called the Economic Support Fund. That program has given Pakistan countless billions. In fact, it gives Pakistan about $240 million in essentially block grant funds. And Pakistan has used those monies to have the world's fastest growing nuclear arsenal in the world. It's set to become the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, inclusive of battlefield nuclear weapons.
Are you saying we helped fund that?
Yeah, we do, because we're just giving Pakistan's Ministry of Finance billions of dollars, no strings attached. They can do whatever they want. Money is fungible. So we are actually subsidizing the things that scare us the most, which is Pakistan's nuclear weapons and Pakistan's continued cultivation of terrorist groups. It gets better. Under the Coalition Support Funds program, we had been paying Pakistan to do what it is required to do, which is keep its country free of terrorists. Now, what the Trump administration has done is actually very devious, and this is actually what's been missed in all of the brouhaha over Trump's tweets, which is why I believe Trump tweets as he does, is to actually hide the truth. The truth is that in November, as Congress was legislating the National Defense Authorization Act for the following fiscal year, his Secretary of Defense, Mattis, pressured Congress to actually make the restrictions on those monies less harsh. For the last several years, including under the Obama administration, Pakistan was given around $1 billion, plus or minus $100 million. And of that, about $300 million could not be given to Pakistan if they did not take confirmable action to eliminate the Haqqani network and Lashkar-e-Taiba from operating on its soil. Since Pakistan did nothing, the Obama administration did not certify that Pakistan was doing so, and Pakistan did not get $300 million. For the last several years, this had been the case. What Trump's Secretary of Defense did was put pressure on the Congress to remove part of those conditionalities. Specifically, it pressured the Congress to remove that part of the legislation that said Pakistan had to act against Lashkar-e-Taiba. And what is so astonishing about that is that it pressured the U.S. Congress to do so after Pakistan had released Hafiz Saeed, who is the leader of Lashkar-e-Taiba, an individual declared to be a terrorist not only by the United States but also the United Nations, after he had already announced the setting up of a political party in which this terrorist, essentially, if you will, the Osama bin Laden of South Asia, intends to contest elections. Essentially, this is the biggest bait and switch of nonsense. The Trump administration is making a lot of hay over the refusal to give Pakistan $255 million to buy our own stuff. But what it has really done has made it a lot easier for Pakistan to get a much more desirable pot of funds by softening the requirements that Pakistan has to comply with to get those funds.
All right. Well, that, we appreciate your perspective. Christine Fair, Distinguished Associate Professor at Georgetown University. The Trump administration is also reacting to indications North Korea is poised to test another ballistic missile, possibly as soon as this week. In a New Year's Day speech, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said he had a nuclear button on his desk and that the United States should be aware that its entire territory is now within the range of their nuclear strike. In a Tuesday morning tweet, President Trump responded that he, too, has a nuclear button, but it is much bigger and more powerful. The government in Seoul, meanwhile, on Tuesday, responded to an overture from Kim to hold talks from the potential about the potential participation of Pyongyang in February's Winter Olympic Games in South Korea. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley told reporters at the United Nations that North Korea can talk with anyone they want, but the U.S. is not going to recognize it or acknowledge it until they agree to ban the nuclear weapons that they have.
As we hear reports that North Korea might be preparing for another missile test, I hope that does not happen. But if it does, we must bring even more measures to bear on the North Korean regime. The civilized world must remain united and vigilant against the rogue state's development of a nuclear arsenal. We will never accept a nuclear North Korea.
Well, Kim's overture might be an attempt to drive a wedge between Seoul and Washington, but the State Department insisted Tuesday that that will not happen. Meanwhile, President Trump praised Iranian protesters Tuesday, saying they were finally acting against the brutal and corrupt regime in Tehran after Iran's supreme leader accused the government's enemies of stirring up the sometimes violent anti-government demonstrations. Trump said in a Twitter comment that, quote, all of the money that his predecessor, former President Barack Obama, quote, so foolishly gave Iran as part of a 2015 international agreement to control Iran's nuclear weapons development program, quote, went into terrorism and into their pockets. VOA special contributor Greta Van Susteren sat down with National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and asked for his take on what's been happening with these protests in Iran.
Well, the Iranian people are expressing frustration, about a regime that pays more attention to exporting terrorism than it does to meeting the needs of its own people. So the president has been very strong in his support for the Iranian people and their rights to express themselves. And I think what's most important now is for the whole world to tell Iran that they have to respect the rights of their citizens and allow them to demonstrate peacefully and to not engage in the kind of violence against the demonstrators that we saw, remember, back in 2009, and that we're starting to see now as well.
Well, in 1956, we had a similar situation. Hungary and the West didn't support the protesters there. We've seen it in the early 90s with the Kurds in Iraq. And again, the United States voices support but didn't do anything. And we, as you mentioned, 2009, when President Obama was president and the Green Movement after the election. Is this administration going to do anything more than voice verbal support for the protesters, or can they?
Well, we'll see what options are available, but I think what we need is strong voices across the world on behalf of the Iranian people. This is a dictatorial regime that is oppressing its own people, that is using the resources that this great nation with this rich culture and rich history needs to foment hatred and violence across the greater Middle East. They are a driving force behind this fitna, behind this sectarian civil war that has caused so much pain and suffering and death in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen. They pose a continuing threat to Israel and within Lebanon to its stability. And this regime has to be held to account, and it seems as if the Iranian people are expressing their displeasure about the behavior of this regime and prioritizing this kind of violence over the benefit of and the welfare of their own citizens.
I was comparing and contrasting my own mind in 2009, which was provoked by an election that the people then, they were unhappy with the election, they thought it was unfair. This one is a little bit different, almost spontaneously in a number of cities that there's been a protest. At first, the suggestion was that it was as a result of an economic situation, that any sort of the economic benefits that they anticipated from the Iran deal didn't trickle down to them. Why do you think this is, was this provoked by economics or by Western influence? Why do you think the protests were sparked in the first place?
I think what's key is to let the Iranian people speak for themselves on this. I think it's dissatisfaction with this dictatorial regime. It was over economics to a certain extent, and the skyrocketing of prices, the very high rate of unemployment, especially among young Iranians. And these are people who know the great potential of their country, and they're frustrated to not be able to take advantage of that potential. But it's also been about the external behavior of the regime and how this is a regime that gives safe haven to Al-Qaeda terrorists who target Shia Christians, anybody who doesn't do, and any Muslim who doesn't adhere to their narrow and irreligious definition of Islam. And so this is a regime that is dishonest fundamentally, and a regime that has helped drive violence and hatred across the whole region.
National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster speaking to VOA Special Contributor Greta Van Susteren. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Record cold weather has killed 9 people across the United States. The U.S. coal mining deaths surge in 2017 after hitting a record low. UN Security Council welcomes 6 new members. And President Trump says he is confident immigrant activists will eventually support him. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. And turning now to our social media segment, we are joined by VOA's Doug Bernard. Doug, the situation with Iran is lighting up the internet, particularly when it comes to President Trump's attacks against Iranian leadership via Twitter.
Well, certainly there's been a lot of attention focused on President Trump's tweets about Iran, North Korea and Pakistan as well, but certainly about Iran, whether he should be saying these things, whether he's insulting various foreign leaders and whether they're insulting him back. But you probably know that Twitter and Facebook and a lot of the popular social media platforms in the West are banned in Iran. So while we're seeing a lot of people in the West, in, say, the Persian diaspora, talking about, you know, what's going on there. We're not getting a lot of information coming right from the ground in Iran via those social media networks. Now, it will start to leak out to them. But in the meantime, there is another story that is making rounds in social media, and it's about social media. It involves a YouTube celebrity, as they call him. He's a vlogger named Logan Paul, and he's very young. He's apparently very successful, makes a lot of money at this stuff. Recently, he was in Japan, and he and some friends decided to take a tour or a tromp through Aokigahara Forest. Now, some people may recognize this. Aokigahara is a large, very old forest at the base of Mount Fuji. It's also known as the Suicide Forest because over 100 Japanese a year go there to commit suicide for various reasons. So here he is kind of tromping around, and sure enough, he and his friends happen upon a man who had taken his own life by hanging himself. And rather than shutting the camera off there or, you know, doing whatever it, perhaps a more culturally sensitive person might do, he and his friends started talking about it. They got right up close to the body as it was hanging there. Very graphic, very close images. Toward the end of the video, they were even kind of joking and laughing. And YouTube has just sort of, social media, I should say, has just exploded with anger at this guy. Lauren Duca in Tokyo writes, Logan Paul is an amoral, expletive deleted, who could not be less deserving of his platform. Aaron Paul, not related, he's the actor. How dare you? You disgust me. I can't believe so many people look up to you. So sad. Hopefully this video woke them up. You are pure trash. Andrew Reiner here writing, can we start 2018 by removing all Logan Paul content from the internet? That has been echoed by a lot of people. Someone identifies himself as Reagan. YouTube needs to take down Logan Paul's account. How can you allow something so sensitive to go on and have the power to stop it, but don't do anything about it? So huge backlash against Logan Paul. He's apologized, sort of. Basically saying it was a dumb mistake, but it was sort of one of those apologies by not apology. Anyway, there's a great deal of talk about this on YouTube, and, you know, by extension, you know, what are the limits? What can and can't be shared on social media? What's appropriate? So that's some of what's going on out there in the electronic world today.
All right, Doug, thank you so much. That's VOA's Doug Bernard. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
The VOA's International Edition continues. Well, according to two organizations, 2017 was the safest year on record for the commercial airline industry. No major airline experienced a plane crash anywhere in the world, according to a Dutch aviation consultancy. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Todd Curtis of airsafe.com just how significant this report is.
It is an amazing record in that, looking back at my own records, looking at just jet airliner events, the last time there was a calendar year with not a single passenger killed, either through a jet airliner accident or a deliberate action like a hijacking or bombing, the last year that happened was 1959. And every year since then, there's been at least one jet event where at least one passenger was killed. So this is truly noteworthy. And in fact, I was just reviewing the record. The last time there was a scheduled airliner or a regular airliner flight with a passenger fatality anywhere in the world was in May 2016. So we're talking roughly 19 months where this has not happened. And the previous gap that I could find was less than 12 months. So again, it's not just the calendar year. This is a broader issue here. That is, I believe that many efforts throughout the years are culminating in the risk of aviation being much, much lower than it would have been even thought possible 20 or 30 years ago.
Much of the credit, according to one report, for reducing passenger airline fatalities goes to aircraft safety systems that have, according to this report, virtually eliminated mid-air collisions.
That's certainly one issue that was a problem 20 or 30 years ago. And due to a combination of both technology and procedures, it's much less likely to happen today. Now, the technology that's in place is a standard technology for jet airliners and for many larger aircraft. Even corporate aircraft would have this sort of avoidance technology for mid-air collisions. Unfortunately, smaller aircraft, private aircraft especially, and some military aircraft would not have this. So although the risk has been reduced between airliners, the risk still exists between airliners and other kinds of aircraft.
There have been concern about air traffic control issues. Have they been pretty much worked out?
Some issues have been worked out. Some issues still need some work to be done. For instance, this is an issue that harkens back to the MH370 event of several years ago. Air traffic control over ocean areas is not anywhere near as close or as sophisticated as the traffic control over land areas. There are some technologies that are in place right now. Specifically, I'm thinking of the Iridium satellite system, the new Iridium satellite system, which actually has receivers on board that will allow a certain kind of air traffic control signal to be picked up from anywhere on Earth. And once this new satellite constellation is in place, and more importantly, once procedures are in place on the ground, there will not be any excuse for any airliner not to be in sight of air traffic control, no matter where they are over the ocean, over the ice caps, or over the land.
This conjures up the unexplained, mysterious disappearance of that Malaysian airliner, MH370, a couple of years ago. Do you think that'll ever be resolved?
I fully believe that the wreckage of MH370 will be found, and if that wreckage is found in within a few years, where they may be able to recover the data from the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder, we would probably have a very good idea what happened to that aircraft. However, if it's not found within a few years' time, I'm afraid that the corrosive properties of the ocean will render the data unusable. So although I'm sure the wreckage will be found, I just hope it's not found 40 or 50 or 60 years from now.
This ought to give, in the new year, the traveling public some good news.
Well, I hope that this will not be the last year that this happens, and that the good fortune that happened in 2017 wasn't a matter of luck, but a matter of both skill and very dedicated work on the part of people throughout the aviation system.
It's Todd Curtis of airsafe.com. It's not an Olympic sport, but at least not yet, but pinball is a growing body of top-level athletes and a growing number of international competitions, Faith Lapidus reports.
Pinball, which has been around since the 1870s, requires a steady hand and flexible hips. Players showed off their moves at the Chicago Pinball Expo, one of nearly 4,500 competitions around the world this year.
Pinball is not going away. It can't be replicated, so I think that's why it never truly goes away.
Zach Sharp, spokesman for the world's leading pinball manufacturer, Stern Pinball, is currently ranked number one of more than 55,000 ranked players.
I don't care where I'm ranked. Whenever I get a chance to compete, I want to win. And if I don't win, then, you know, on to the next tournament.
The game attracts players of all ages, including Escher Lefkoff, who started playing before he was old enough to reach the flippers without help. Earlier this year, at 13, he became the youngest world champion pinball player.
It was my day. I played great that day, and I won, and it was the most magical moment of my life.
His father, Adam, is also a ranked player, and there's a bit of friendly rivalry in the household.
Now, of course, Escher has won the world championships. And when we count world championships in our household, I've won, let's see, zero, and Escher has one. So Escher wins.
The resurgence of interest in pinball has made the machine's manufacturers winners, too. Revenue at Stern Pinball this year was up 30% over 2016, which was up 40% over 2015. The factory produces about 50 games a day.
It takes about 30 hours from start to finish. All these games are hand-built, so it's not like there's machines automating this.
That includes making the cabinets, pressing the playfield, running the wiring, and installing around 3,500 parts, all for the excitement of keeping that little silver ball in play. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Patrick Dea. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
9 years ago, Russian lawyer and tax accountant Sergei Magnitsky uncovered a 5.4 billion ruble tax fraud scheme while auditing the Russia-based Hermitage Fund. He also found that a number of Russian Interior Ministry officials were deeply involved. For exposing this fraud, Magnitsky was arrested by Russian authorities and subjected to organized physical and psychological pressures while detained. On November 16, 2009, he died in a pretrial detention center in Moscow. Initially, Russian officials said his death was caused by cramped conditions and failure to provide adequate health care, but they later changed their story. Investigations were initiated, but all those implicated were acquitted and the charges were dropped. In 2012, the U.S. Congress passed the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act, which provides for the sanctioning of persons determined to have been involved in the criminal conspiracy uncovered by Sergei Magnitsky. In addition, the act provides for the sanctioning of individuals determined to be responsible for or to have profited from Magnitsky's detention, abuse, and death. The Magnitsky Act also provides for the sanctioning of persons determined to be responsible for extrajudicial killings, torture, or other gross violations of internationally recognized human rights against individuals who seek to expose illegal activity by Russian officials. On December 20, 2017, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated five individuals pursuant to the Magnitsky Act. Significantly, among those sanctioned are the head of the Chechen Republic, Ramzan Kadyrov, and captain in the Chechen Ministry of Internal Affairs, Ayub Katayev, who are responsible for extrajudicial killings or other gross human rights violations against activists working to expose illegal activity by Russian government officials or individuals seeking to obtain, exercise, defend, or promote their internationally recognized human rights and freedoms. Also sanctioned are Alexei Shishinya, Yulia Mayorova, and Andrei Pavlov, who were involved in the fraud scheme originally uncovered by Sergei Magnitsky. This brings the number of individuals sanctioned under the Magnitsky Act to a total of 49 since the legislation was enacted. Sanctioned persons may be ineligible to receive visas to the United States. Any property or interest in property of sanctioned persons within U.S. jurisdiction are blocked, and transactions by U.S. persons involving sanctioned persons are generally prohibited. Treasury remains committed to holding accountable those involved in the Sergei Magnitsky affair, said OFAC Director John E. Smith. We will continue to use the Magnitsky Act to aggressively target gross violators of human rights in Russia, including individuals responsible for extrajudicial killings, torture, and other despicable acts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.